that fantasy that whatever you pulled out of your attic or basement is going to be this home run. And don't you think that's basically the phenomenon that sellers in Montana have?
I'm Coulter DeVries, owner of Ranch Investor Advisory and Brokerage Services. I'm an accredited land consultant with the Realtor Land Institute and proud member of ASFMRA.
The Ranch Investor Podcast is the most downloaded and informative industry-specific content that intrigues while entertains.
Andy Ron.
Well, hello.
Welcome back.
Thanks. It's been a little bit.
It has been a while. So we are just about tax day, April.
What?
Mid-April.
Shoot.
2024.
I got to go. Yeah.
Go file an extension.
Yeah, right.
That's a free loan from the government.
Oh, okay.
That's a zero interest rate loan. So
can you just continually roll them over?
Yeah, refinance your tax due.
Right.
Re-amortize that for me. I'll pay it next year. Mm. I'll get you. I'm good for it.
Right.
Till I die. Then you can come after everything I've bought without paying taxes on.
Everything I don't have.
Yeah. Everything I've transferred out before death. Well, yeah, April. 2024. What's going on in the ranch market?
Well, I mapped four new ranches today. So I've been kind of waiting because usually spring, you know, we see a ramp up because it's coming into ideal showing time, right? Green on the fields and snow in the mountains.
That's what us brokers like to tell everyone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Get it signed now. Get the listing agreement signed now. It's best showing season coming up. Green grass shots.
Yeah.
I got to get my photography out there.
Waiting to see, you know, if we're going to see some inventory rebuild. And I mean, maybe barely, but still kicking around just barely over 300 listings.
The inventory will rebuild as we continue to see the spread in bid ask. The bid price and the ask price, the spread, the difference is just widening.
I have seen a lot of high price listings come on the market. I'm, you know, just surprised at the pricing.
Yeah. And the buyers aren't there.
Yeah.
And that's going to reduce the conversion rate of properties leaving the market. So supply in the farm and ranch will increase.
Well, and I haven't had a chance to follow up with these brokers and you know, not all brokers want to talk to you about this, but just those pricing, you know, you wonder if it's seller directed. I mean, it usually is, especially when it's really high, you know, and it's just got to be the classic, you know, Montana land seller that's got their price but not very motivated past that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I made an offer on one listing in Eastern Montana recently, and the offer was 50% of asking price. We were at just over a 2 cap on that, how we came up with the value. Mm. And the property was better, in my opinion, it was better attributed as a cap valuation because it was kind of an investor type property. There's a lot to it. It's almost more industrial than it was agriculture.
Hmm. I mean, what kind of industry? Any timber?
A lot of pumping costs. A lot of pumping, a lot of irrigated farmland.
Gotcha.
And so in my opinion, that plays well to institutional type investors, cash flow type. You're not going to go out there and play cowboy on several thousand irrigated acres
when it's costing you $1,000 a month to water.
Oh, yeah. $10,000 a month. $12,000, $13,000, $14,000 a month. So yeah, I put a cap rate value on it. Came up, given what I thought, you know, just over a 2 cap, which I was like, you know, the market, that this is actually probably higher than what the market requires as a risk adjustment because of all the pumping. Mm-hmm. So really it probably should have been more like a 3 cap. So I thought that our price offer of 50% of asking price was more than reasonable, and we were told to pound sand.
Yeah. I'm curious actually about that. I just recently, a buddy of mine is considering making an offer. It's not quite as low as 50, but it's close. And I am thinking, you know, why bother? And don't you run the risk of, you know, maybe even pissing off your seller? And, you know, is it worth making an ask that low? I mean, you went through it.
I mean, if it's been on the market a while, I tend to believe that, yeah, it's worth making that offer, because you're not the first guy to beat them up on price. You right. never want to be the first, second, or third guy to beat them up on price. You want to be the fourth.
Right, right. I will say I've had brokers, selling brokers, be a bit encouraging about it, because they want their sellers to be beat up a little bit because they know they need it.
Yeah.
But they can't do it, or they've tried, you know.
And we want, you know, we give them a CMA. Mm-hmm. And then when the sellers say, oh, no, double it, put it on the market. Take that CMA, double it, and put it on the market. You know, then when offers come in at where our BPO was, at least a broker's price opinion, then it's confirmation.
Right.
This is what we told you, and we were being factual and forthright with you.
Back when I had my license, the last listing I had, we only got two offers in 2 years. They were both the exact same price, and they were both half of what the list was. And I remember the seller at the kitchen table saying, I just don't understand it. I just don't. Why that number?
Because the buyer's done their homework,
and they weren't connected. They didn't have access to each other's offers, so they were two independent offers, the exact same price, half price a list, and the seller was just couldn't wrap her brain around what was going on.
That is funny, because farm and ranch is different than other areas of real estate, right?
Yeah.
And I've been in the position of trying to buy a house right now, which is not fun. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, we have one under contract, but the first four offers I wrote, I was off quite a bit. I was off 20% of asking price, actually. Mm-hmm. On average. Yeah. I came in 20% less than the asking price. And that's because 2023 was weak in residential.
Yeah. Softened quite a bit.
And my theory was that interest rates are going to stay the same. Inflation's not going to continue ticking up, although I'm wrong there. We're starting to see that it is ticking up again, because the Billings residential market, we're back into multiple offer situations. I did write a full price offer on a house we really liked, and there were seven higher than mine.
At full price?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Which was a funny situation, because the listing agent, she didn't have to, but she came back and she said, Coulter, there's going to be seven more offers coming in. And I said, bullshit. I'm not making an offer above asking price in this market. And we really love the house. But we found one that works.
Well, I'm just continually surprised how, and I've been kind of thinking about the best language on this, but how divorced sellers are from market phenomenon. So, you know, remember the presentation I gave every year in February, and the most surprising thing that I came up with as I was, you know, going through all my data on that was showing that going into the end of 2020, 2021, 22, which were record setting years in the Montana land market. Like, I'm not sure we'll see that again in our lifetime kind of deal. There was no bump in supply. There was no, I mean, you know, we know the story now. We burn through inventory, and that's where we're still at, is a, you know, as a depressed inventory situation, because we burn through inventory. But there was no bump in the rate or the number of listings. No, I mean, what market doesn't have that big of a increase in demand and have a corresponding reaction with supply?
However, there was all that off-market activity.
Yes, that's true. But I still think, though, the data shows that there's a surprising disconnect between market forces and the sellers in Montana.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I think, and you can comment on this, surely. You know, I think when sellers go to market, it's largely internal factors that drive that. Families are ready, you know, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, it's rare. I don't know. Have you ever heard, you know, someone say, boy, you know, I've been watching the market closely, and I think I, you know, now's the time to sell. You know, it seems like
no,
they get divorced. They get, yep. You know, the breaking point. If we're talking about, you know, old multifamily ownerships that finally hit the market, usually it's some kind of breaking point within the family kind of thing. You know, the offsite siblings have had it.
Yeah.
Forced the sale, or, you know, mom dies or dad dies and that's it, or, you know, stuff like that.
Oh, I can relate personally. We're kind of going through that right now with my family and part of the ranch. And I was drawing up the CMA, and I, you know, trying to tell all my brothers and my dad what I think it's worth. And then I got to thinking about it as someone who has an interest in this. I'm a part owner of that.
Yeah.
I was like, well, bullshit. If it, you know, the market's telling me it's worth that, but I would never sell it for that.
And plus your dad's looking at you and he's like, didn't I wipe that kid's ass just like last week?
Yeah. Why should I take his opinion when we've got, you know, a lot of implications of wealth and legacy, dynasty, and all the years of hard work on your opinion?
Yeah, that's what I think really comes down to. If we're talking about like your family, multi-generational ownerships, it's that's the last asset, or it's accumulation. It's about, you know, I was going to say this earlier, like it never ceases to amaze me when you're talking about ag operators, because their sophistication around markets with their commodities or equipment or is like unbelievable, right? I mean, they are market. They could have, some of these guys could have, should have an honorary PhD. And
they do,
you know, but then land, it just all goes out the window.
Yeah.
They're, you know, and you try to talk to them about supply and demand or what the market's doing, and they just look at you like you're the biggest idiot they've ever come across.
Well, and going back to my experience with residential right now is, so I was writing offers at 80% of asking price. Mm-hmm. And one of the agents, she goes, Coulter, I know that you're a farm and ranch guy, that this isn't your area of expertise, but I know that you guys like negotiate over huge differences, millions of dollars in huge spread, bid ask spread, 40%, 50%. That's not residential. Your offer is not going to work. You can't come in and make an offer 80% of asking price on a home.
That's so funny hearing you say that, a residential broker talk, because I feel like, don't we do that in the opposite? Don't we roll our eyes about residential brokers like they don't know shit? They're, you know, they got this simpler market and you don't understand, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
well, and her point was that they've got it more dialed in.
I wouldn't argue with that.
Liquidity is quicker, I would say, because they price things more accurately.
I would call it a higher functioning market, a better functioning market. There's more,
certainly,
you know, higher volume and more standardized product. It's more of a commodity.
More comps. Yep.
You know, I mean, land in Montana is just doesn't fit, you know, as a commodity.
No replacement.
So it's, I struggle with the term market sometimes. Sometimes I'm like, I don't know if calling this a market quite.
Well, you know what it reminds me of is, I've been getting heavy into Antiques Roadshow on PBS.
Is this your blow off steam? Is this your you come home and tell the wife and kids to shut up and drink your cocktail and watch it? Yes. Antique Roadshow. Yep.
Yeah. So since I'm a millennial, I don't drink, because you know that's the new thing is millennials.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, are drinking mocktails and
they don't have as much sex. They don't drink. What's the it seems like things are going downhill to me, but what do I know?
Do they have any fun at all? They're not drinking and having sex. You guys are a bunch of stick in the mud.
Right? I thought it was supposed to go the other way around.
Yeah. And so I come home and turn on a little Antiques Roadshow on PBS, and my wife watches The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City and drinks fake wine. And I have my...
Just the millennial dream.
Yeah. And I have my decaffeinated coffee. Yep. And, you know, what the wide range of things that come across there, from jewelry, art, furniture, antiques, historical relics, like, you know, Chinese pre-era Chinese pottery, all these things, there is a market for them, right?
Right.
And you do have the appraiser who comes and gives you his opinion, but you just don't know what it's worth until it goes to the auction block. And there, all of these, what I've noticed is a lot of what they feature, these pieces, you should watch this. You should get into some Antiques Roadshow.
You know, I got to admit, I have watched a little bit of, is it Pawn Stars? Kind of a similar deal.
Yeah, yeah.
Where crazy characters come in and demand, you know, that they sell their piece of crap or that their piece of, or, you know, that their jewelry is real when it's not and all this stuff.
These aren't crazy characters. These are everyman's on the antiques.
Isn't part of the appeal of that deal? I mean, some of it's some, you know, it's junk, but it isn't the whole, it's almost like a lottery thing, right? Like some funky little thing that, you know, has been in your family's attic for generations. You pull out and turns out it's a multi-million dollar and they're surprised. And
yes,
it's like winning the lottery. Isn't that kind of the premise of the.
Yeah. Cause like a side table, a Federalist side table from the 1700s, I saw yesterday, he valued at 250,000. And then they updated it. They thought that today it was worth 600,000. And I was like, for a side table? What? did Thomas Jefferson like sign the Declaration of Independence on this? Like
spill some scotch or something.
Yeah. And that's part of the thing is the story behind these pieces. Yeah, so everyone has a story. And a lot of times the appraiser will say, well, you know, actually this is worth more if you can verify and prove that story, corroborate, if someone can do that, you're telling me.
I took an appraisal course and there was an art appraiser in there and he told the story about an Andy Warhol print. He was screwing around with an intern and she tried to shoot him and the bullet went through the print, and it's not one of his best pieces of art, but it's one of his most valuable because of that story.
So there, you own the story. That's you own the right to tell that story. That's like a it's like a copyright. It's like a trade secret, artistic rights.
Well, that's
what you're buying. You're not actually buying the damn thing.
Right.
You're buying the artistic creation of the story behind it.
Well, now you're making me think, you know, all the listings I look at and map as part of Montana Land Source, how poorly sometimes that is marketed. I mean, obviously, brokers are more and more leaning into that all the time, I guess I would say. And sometimes it's just pretty eye-rolly, you know. But other times
I've done some eye rolling.
Yeah. I wasn't mentioning any names. But sometimes it's like, whoa, you know, this place really does have a pretty cool story and it's presented well and that kind of stuff, you know. But I mean, isn't that part of the dream? The cowboy dream is you know, some historical event happened there or, you know, whatever. There's you own a piece of history. You own a piece of the West.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you own a piece of the legacy there. Mm-hmm. And then some of those stories talk about the market, like Jim Espy, he sold a ranch that was near Fort Bighorn, which Fort Bighorn was paramount to the frontier of the West in Montana. And John Coulter carved his name into some sandstone on that ranch he sold.
Either that or Jim.
I have a funny story about something like that. Yeah, we can get to one later like that.
What about the property where John Dutton was shot? Is that gonna
But the thing, like John Coulter, yeah, it's historical, it's really cool, it's super unique, probably not going to influence the value all that much, because the market for John Coulter fans is pretty limited, small.
Right. I bet not a whole lot of them have millions of dollars in their back pocket for a ranch.
No. And I mean, well, and his name, you know, doesn't carry that of Lewis and Clark.
Right.
If it was a Lewis and Clark signature, it'd be worth a lot more on the ranch. Right. But yeah, John Coulter, you know, that's a more nuanced historian, history buff.
Sure.
So limited market there. It's that, I'm sure that aspect didn't influence Jim's sale any more than 1%.
Right. Well, and there, you know, we've seen things, for some reason it makes me think of, I've appraised a couple places with dinosaur bones, and it's like, and the whoever, you know, I'm working for wants a high value in these cases and talking up the value of the dinosaur bones. I remember I did a project in Northern Montana in a ranch with a ton of dinosaur bones, and the buyer bought it for the bones, but he paid market price for, it was mostly a dry cropland place with a whole bunch of, bluffs, a whole bunch of breaks, and the breaks especially is where the bones were exposed. But on, you know, the plateau, the tops were all cropland, and it was like, I don't know, back then it was like $700 an acre, you know, $650 an acre, $700 an acre cropland. That's what he bought it for. So there was no evidence in the market that bones brought any more than than wheat.
And Indian artifacts like arrowheads. So we're going to bring up this story. I had a seller who was just pumping his property to me, just telling me, you know, there used to be Indian battles out here, and you got to put that in your brochure. You got to feature that there's been Indian battles. And I was like, well, going back to like antiques roadshow, can you verify this? Can someone corroborate your story? Let's look into it. Let's provide proof rather than sell blue sky. Let's not sell too much blue sky here.
And
he's like, well, that's your job. You got to look into it. You got to find that out. He's like, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a bunch of stones in a circle, teepee rings. We could do that. Right. And I was like, I'd rather you didn't, now that you told me.
right.
don't do that now. Cause we're going to just drive by it and someone's going to see a bunch of stones in a circle. And I'm not going to put my reputation by saying, yeah, those are teepee rings.
You know, it's back to the old, what's it called? Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah.
I mean, that fantasy that whatever you pulled out of your attic or basement is going to be this home run. And don't you think that's basically the phenomenon that sellers in Montana have?
Because certainly,
you know, there have, even though the actual number of times that, you know, those kind of these home runs or whatever get hit are much lower than people actually think.
Yes.
But they get out, or they get exaggerated. But so every seller thinks they've got a Thomas Jefferson.
Yes.
And you just haven't put enough ads in the Wall Street Journal, is the problem.
Yeah.
As the broker.
And another thing with that, home run, quote unquote, I think that can be normalized, or it's kind of a relative issue. So when they think they're hitting a home run, if they go back and they do the compounded annual growth rate, mm-hmm. since they bought the ranch in, say, the 40s or 50s or 30s, whenever their great grandpa bought it, their compounded annual growth rate might turn out to be 5%.
Right.
Over that many years. It's just a big boon in their lifetime, but over the long term, 5%. Yeah, that's it exceeds the normal of 3%, right?
Doesn't mean beat the equities market though.
Yeah. And that's why I'm saying it can be normalized in a sense that this home run isn't quite the home run you think it is, because it's actually within a reasonable range of time value money adjusted.
Well, and it reminds me, I've known of quite a few properties that, had a really stubborn, obstinate seller. And generally, the market does eventually catch. You know, they might take 10 years, or because there's properties on the market right now that have been on the market for 10 years. And, you know, and then it happens and the seller is like, see, I held out and I got my price. But you look at the time value of money.
Exactly.
And the opportunity costs that they foregoed in that. And I've had this conversation trying to get sellers to be more. And it's funny, too, right? Because, you know, we've been in very favorable market conditions. You're trying to convince them to sell in a favorable market condition for a good price. And they, you know, they want to fight with you and then dink around for years till they finally get it sold. But yeah, the lost opportunity they had at that time.
Yep. Which probably looks like a break even.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But in their minds, I held out strong and I got what I asked for.
Yeah,
I can go to the coffee shop with my head held high and brag about I got what I asked for.
Yeah. You know, I'm flashing back to the episode you had with Dallas, the owner of Ranching for Profit.
Yes.
And his comments. You guys were talking about, you know, a little bit bemoaning the loss of the multi-generational, you know, family operator. But he made a comment about how god awful inefficient some of those places are. And especially the ones that sell. And that actually really resonated with me. And I think there's something to do with that when it comes time to trade too, right? Just not I don't know if efficient's the right word, but they're not approaching the sale of it all that
analytical.
Yeah, I mean,
the old generational operator running his ranch doesn't use KPIs.
Yeah.
They're not doing balance sheet analysis and cash flow analysis. And then when it comes to analyzing that asset,
yeah,
they're not doing that either.
You know what that reminds me of? There used to be, you ever remember Phillips Office Supply on Main Street Bozeman? Is that too old for you?
I believe so.
Yeah, it was this old, and it closed, right? That was the news. I mean, it'd been there forever, downtown store, right? And I was somewhere having, conversation about this, and some guy says, "You mean that place that's been trying to go out of business for 20 years?" Like you'd go to buy a pencil there, and as likely as not, the eraser would be rock hard when you went to go. Right? So it's like, well, you bemoan whatever a local, historical place, but it's like these places gotta, if they're not efficient, if they're not, producing food or fiber at an efficient rate, if they're not supporting people on the place,
Yeah. Well, why do we need to support lifestyles? Why is that noble?
Right.
Why is there more inherent value to people having a lifestyle that they desire and that they chose and that they are wanting to pursue voluntarily on their own accord?
It is pretty sad when you show up in a place and the place is pretty beat to death. And now that I'm kind of thinking about this and talking about it, sometimes the people look a little bit beat to death.
For sure. Hey,
kind of worn down, and
I can attest to that. That's personal.
Yeah. And I mean, we don't want them all to trans. I mean, we want to preserve culture. We want to preserve all that, but there's got to be a middle. I mean, that's why what's the outfit called? Ranch for profit.
Yeah,
is stuff like that is so great. Like actually trying to help people potentially, make it.
Well, we're getting into campaign season and we have the number one Senate race in the United States.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I guess that race has been that way
many times. Yep.
I mean, going back to Tester and Burns, right? Didn't Tester and Burns first break that?
Well, and then Daines and the former governor, Bullock.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that the Montana seat has always been viewed as a contested one to swing the Senate. Well, not always, but in the last 16 years, right?
Right.
Because they viewed Montana as a purple state, which has been.
Right. Historically. Yeah.
Yeah. And so now, we're going to have the most funded Senate race in the nation.
The highest dollar Senate race.
Which brings out all the Carhartt jackets.
Right. American flags, guns, yep. Carhartt jackets.
Yep. Cowboys, farmers.
John Deere tractor.
Yep. And one of the issues that keeps coming up on, both sides, they spin it, they pitch it how they want because they want to be viewed as the populist, right?
Right.
That they're part of the good old boys.
People.
Yep. And it's this idea of protecting the family farmer and supporting the family farmer. And I see a lot of this and I'm like, that's kind of bullshit to me because a lot of these people, that sounds elitist.
With your decaf coffee over there.
Yeah, people are listening to this and be like, God, is culture a progressive in San Francisco?
Which podcast am I on?
But they chose to be farmers and ranchers, and a lot of it is lifestyle. They're not driven by KPIs and, like you said, efficiencies and economies. And then two, they're what I've seen from my network, my peers, and just my own experience being in it. A lot of these people, it's a trade. It's a skill set. They're good at that.
You're talking about politicians?
Family farmers.
Oh, family farmers. Yeah.
Family farmers. And they're, to me, I'm sitting here wondering, well, the rest of us, we have to be adaptable.
Right.
We have to change when our industry goes to shit, when my business goes to shit, I have to adapt. I have to find something else to do. I have to pick up a new skill, a new trade. Why don't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's one of the most subsidized industries in the country, you know, ag.
Yeah. Right? Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
You know, yeah. Speaking of political season and whatnot. Well, and of course, one of the issues is foreign ownership of land, right?
What a bullshit issue.
We had the Chinese balloon, you know, and everything like that. I feel like it's trying to put toothpaste back in a tube. And maybe you remember this or can correct me. So, you know, we've been in desperate need of processing facilities. You know, we got really in this zone where we're producing, you know, all these calves, the world's best calves, and shipping them to other places to get processed. We lost all our processing. And there was a multi-million dollar big processing unit proposed for Miles City, and it was Chinese money.
JD.com.
And the Chinese, they came out, and the stock growers were all about it.
Yep.
You know, now all of a sudden foreign ownership is like this political issue and everybody's worked up about it. And, you know,
they keep running those ads that I'm going to stop China from buying U.S. farmland.
Well, and the toothpaste out of the tube for me is, I mean, we have a free market. I mean, aside from like, you know, criminals or something, we don't ask people where their money comes from. I mean, we take money, right?
Exactly.
We have a free open market.
Yeah.
But now all of a sudden, you know, for political expediency, we want to, and it's a globalized society, globalized world.
It's a complete bullshit issue because one, it's not a problem.
Yeah.
And number two, how are you going to limit the CCP from buying U.S. farmland without limiting everyone else?
Well, you know who, I actually went to a presentation that MSU put on this, and you know who, well, first of all, the biggest, you know, the most foreign money is coming from Canada.
Ontario Teachers Pension Fund.
Yeah, I mean the amount of bad actors, China, Venezuela, Iran, North Korea, you know, is minimal. First of all, and you know what, most of the foreign entities are buying is energy lands for wind leases and oil leases, and that's the biggest target is energy.
Yeah, why take $10 million of your sovereign wealth and turn it into seven?
Yeah.
No, it's if I were so, and they're like, well, the Chinese bought farmland near an Air Force base in North Dakota.
Right.
Okay. Well, if I was the CCP with nefarious intentions, I wouldn't just come out as the CCP and buy farmland. I would have a trust in Switzerland that owns an LLC in the Netherlands, that owns an S Corp in Ireland, that also is part of a trust in the Cayman Islands, and that trust would buy the land. So
maybe you need to open up a consulting firm for
that sounds like, what the hell is it called when you sell out your own country?
Traitorism?
Well, yeah, traitor. but there's a legitimate term for that.
When you sell out?
Yeah.
Turncoat? I don't know.
Benedict Arnold.
Right. Yeah, I find that.
Sedition?
Maybe. Yeah. I didn't pay attention.
I think it's sedition.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Because the other word I often confuse it with is... what the hell they try to call people like me on January? Insurrectionist.
Yeah.
So to consult for the CCP on buying farmland, I'd be a seditionist.
Yeah.
Not an insurrectionist like I was in Washington on January 6th.
Are they coming for you next?
I'm going to get a knock on the door. So... I did once say I'd try to keep this non-political.
See how that went.
What else is going on since you last came?
You know, it's funny. I feel like I got to tell a Bozeman story. I had a nice cross-state road trip. I went to Butte. I went to Missoula. I have family in Missoula and, you know, met with some folks out there and had a great time. Felt like just like a second hometown out there. I mean, I did my freshman year of college out there and like I said, have family out there, and, you know, just had one of these trips where you just love Montana and open road and all that kind of stuff. But then I come back to Bozeman, and I'll remind people, I lived in Bozeman for about 17 years up till about 6 years ago. And I decided to check out the top of the Armory, the 9-story.
Yeah. I went and had a drink up there.
Yeah. I was going to have a drink at the Armory.
Non-alcoholic, of course.
Yeah. And, you know, this whole trip being on the road, I hadn't experienced 1 ounce of boredom or loneliness until I sat at the top of the Armory and had an $18 old fashioned, and was treated with almost complete disinterest and disdain from the uber hot bartender.
Yeah, it's a whole other culture, isn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, like I said, I lived there for 17 years. You know, I think I'd have some
clout.
Yeah. Do you know who I am?
You need to go to the American Eagle for that.
Yeah, it was funny. I was telling some friends, complaining to some friends about it, and they were like, well, obviously you went to the wrong place. The Hop is still there for you, buddy.
Yeah, the Legion.
Well, it was funny because I stepped foot in the Rhino at Missoula, and didn't even intend to stop, didn't even intend to have a drink. And 3 hours later, I'm chatting up with the whole bar. Everybody knows somebody that knows somebody.
Yep.
You know, classic old Montana.
The Rhino was the bar I went to when I went to school there in Missoula.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, geez. So now we're talking about these cultural differences coming to Montana. I did go to, I stopped through Missoula the other day too, and went to a coffee shop where the coffee stirrers were pasta sticks.
Hmm.
More sustainable.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I went in the bathroom, they had a list of local events, and only in Missoula in the men's, or it wasn't a men's bathroom. It was
women's
either.
It was
either anything.
Were you confused? Were you, was it, were you?
I was a little scared to go in. Like, am I going to look like a pedo if I get this wrong? What's the answer here? I don't know what these signs are. But yeah, on the bathroom wall was an advertisement for West African dance classes in Missoula, Montana. And I was boy, that is very different than what I see in Ekalaka, Montana.
Yeah. You know, I spent quite a bit of time just walking around downtown Missoula because I hadn't been in a while. And I definitely saw some of the same Bozeman type stuff, you know, high-end shops and shiny people and stuff. But, you know, I feel like Missoula is still putting up something of a fight. You know, it's just, it's the liberal, for maybe people that don't know, out of state, it's where the liberal arts school is, University of Montana. So it's always been the hippie capital of Montana, you know, for a long time. And social consciousness has been, or whatever, social justice.
Yeah.
Right. That's been its deal. And I've been in Missoula, like, I feel like it's at least putting up a fight. It's at least pushing back. Whereas Bozeman is just completely
folded.
Tipped. Yeah. Bozeman is just like, well, in downtown Bozeman, which has often been celebrated as a great, you know, even historic, you know, down Montana downtown, at this point, it's almost all shopping and not for locals, you know, high end shops and all this kind of stuff. I mean, there's the holdout Ace Hardware and a couple bars and stuff, but, you know.
Yeah. And that whole, they are elitist. And wow, that was a broad generalization.
So that's rich coming from an elitist.
Well, and I was gonna say, who am I to cast a stone when I'm like, you guys aren't Montanans,
right?
Like, Bozeman is 20 miles from Montana.
That
sounds a little snobby and elitist.
Well, you know, although, and I mean, this is honestly what pushed me out. I love Bozeman. I probably at one point thought I might stay there forever. And I don't think it's a characterization of the people that have moved in. I think it's a factor of volume. It's just been inundated, you know, and you just community frays. It just, you just don't recognize people on the street and all that kind of stuff. So it's just, and I think with the exception of maybe Whitefish, you know, those two communities are the only, you know, are communities in Montana that are completely transformed. I mean, almost unrecognizable from what they were a generation ago. Like I'm saying about Missoula, it's putting up, it's still kind of trying, it's trying to navigate those waters of new types, new level of wealth, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, and you know, towns like Livingston, and there's a number of them, you know, but I think Bozeman and maybe Whitefish have just completely, they're unrecognizable.
Yeah. Bozeman did elect a young socialist mayor.
Yeah. Right.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah. I mean, Bozeman used to be Caltech town. Yeah,
it's changing, but we've got to adapt, right?
But places like, you know, Billings has this just slow and steady growth rate that never changes no matter what, you know?
And look at the amount of new units, homes and shit going up in Billings and commercial. Like, man, what is the new numbers? We've grown population probably 20% in the last 5 years.
I don't think it's as that high, but
it's huge.
Yeah.
It's not 20%.
It's a big change. Yeah. So, I wanted to bring this up, you know, talking about the land market and stuff and inventory, you know, it's been speculated, whether or not there might be a secondary market, all the people that moved here in such a haste, you know, a couple winters, of course we haven't had any brutal winters to speak of, but
yeah,
you know, that, you know, coming with some haste, you know, is there going to be a fallout within a few years of people not being quite what they expected? And is that going to create a secondary market almost?
Or attrition, washout?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anecdotally, the people I run into, like at the gym, who moved here, some of these are COVID refugees.
Yeah.
And they love it. They love Billings. Like, and they had no connection. It was a cold move is hard to sustain.
Right.
If you don't have family or an employer.
Right.
Especially for a millennial with kids. Like, if you don't have mom and dad around, grandma and grandpa, raising kids is pretty freaking hard.
Right.
And so for some of these people, their cold move has lasted. And another one is like people in my daughter's Montessori. Mm-hmm. Dude, they love it.
Elitist. liberal elite. That's what's going on here.
Anti-public schools. Yeah, they seem like they're here to stay.
Well, another demographic that I can speak to, and I'm kind of one of them, is people moving back home that never thought they would do that, maybe. Or, you know, if you asked them 20 years ago, you know, they'd be like, oh, Christ, no, you know. But you know, it's part of it's an age thing. I think that's probably pretty natural, you know, as you get to a certain age, like, oh, hometown doesn't look so bad. And, you know, maybe, and I'm talking as a Gen Xer, right? Older generation, parents are aging. Oh, got to be closer to mom and dad that's aging out. But I also think there's a cultural change. And I think about even really small towns in Montana. I mean, every little town in Montana has a groovy coffee shop and a brewery and a, you know what I mean? Yeah,
totally.
So like people that...
When Harlow has a brewery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So especially small town Montana and people that were kind of like, you know, I'm out of here type deal, never looking back. Then, and maybe they've gone somewhere and gotten beat up in the big city for a while. And they're just like, you know, home doesn't sound so bad. And there's cultural amenities that I was really missing. I mean, part of why I fled. But now, you know, the brewery has a guy strumming guitar, you know, every Friday, Saturday night in the corner. So it's like, oh, I got some.
The map of sex offenders is far more sparsely populated. Right.
And I wasn't so hardcore that I like, you know, I'll never come back to Billings kind of thing. But yeah, you know, and it's like this place looks pretty darn good compared to a lot of other places.
I'd noticed that like, you know, about 10 years ago when the boomers started retiring and moving back to the boomers who went off and made their careers elsewhere and then came back to, well, my home area, Carbon County. Mm-hmm. Like I loved seeing that they came back and got on the museum board and the cemetery board and got involved. And one guy who we're going to have on the podcast, he like a PhD toxicologist, so he knows statistics, he knows research very well. He has been testing rock crick and he's put together a study that shows that all the development happening in the Rock Crick Valley with septic systems and drain fields is causing higher nitrogen levels in rock crick. And that's all volunteer work on his own time. He's a retired boomer. And like, dude, that's what we need. We need talent like that coming back with the time.
Right.
And I love seeing that because at the same time, you get these people on these boards for like cattlemen's groups and farm groups. And they're like, oh, you young people, you got to get involved. And it's like, we got to raise some damn kids here. We got to establish our careers. You
guys, we got to pay for your social security fund. That's not solvent.
Do you want to work till you're 85?
Right.
No, you guys go to the community meetings and sit on those boards and committees and that shit, because we have constraints.
Right.
So it's good to see the boomers coming back and applying their talents and their time.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioning Rock Creek made me think of the floods a couple of years ago, and spent a fair amount of time on the river that summer, you know, after the floods were gone. And it was amazing because the Lower Yellowstone, which is usually pretty brown, was pretty clean, right? Flushed out, you know, except for the occasional refrigerator or washing machine floating by.
See, and that's why people love it here, is because it's a fridge and not a dead body.
Yeah. Yeah, that might be coming.
Oh, well, 45 minutes in, any market analysis, some numbers, data, statistics to bring up?
Let me see. Let me pull up this handy website, Montana Land Source, that's got live market statistics. Yeah, I mean, you know, like I talked about earlier, just waiting for inventory to rebuild. But I mean, we've got 50% less new listings so far in 2024 than 2023.
Wow. That's a surprise.
I know. But I mean, inventory, well, I say creeping up. I guess that's not really true. I mean, just barely. So still seeing shorter days on market. Number of sales is up from last year slightly. You know, I just think I've been criticized for using this word recovery, because most people think recovery is from a bad time, not from a good time. But as an appraiser, you know, I see extremes on either side as kind of the same. They're disruptive markets and unreal markets. So I'm not bothered by the term recovery, but I just get the sense that it's kind of a let things sort out, let the
take years.
Yeah.
It's going to take years to normalize back to 2019 activity levels and metrics.
But, you know, there's still demand is still strong from what I hear from all the brokers. They all talk about, you know, having buyers that just haven't found the right place and that kind of stuff. It's all due to low inventory. Can't find what you want.
The salesmen are telling you that demand is strong.
Yeah. Grain of salt.
That's like, this other property I was working with on a buyer right now, actually. And again, we on this other one, we're at 50% our evaluation versus asking price. We're 50% from where they are at. And the listing agent keeps telling us, oh, he's really motivated. He wants to sell this ranch. he's got another one in mind. He wants to get moved to that other one. And I'm like, yeah, he's motivated at his price.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right.
Aren't we all?
Well, you know, one thing I've always embraced as an appraiser, I love the concept. So like when I write an appraisal, you know, I am not an advocate. I'm not supposed to be an advocate. If anything, I'm an advocate for the market. And I've always liked that, wanted to lean in onto that. So I think I always have some optimism when we get through extremes and kind of come back to normalcy that normal market factors will, but it's always fleeting.
Yeah. Well,
it's a,
if there's one thing I kind of take from all of this is that, I don't think farm and ranch is knee jerk. It's not volatile. It didn't move a lot as your data shows, wasn't a lot of people rushing to sell when times were good.
Well, here's an interesting, this is reminding me, I've kind of been working on a blog along these lines. And again, just talking about the Montana land market. And one thing that occurred to me, the Montana land market is a highly imperfect market. We talked about that earlier, just, you know, it's a non-disclosure state. There's not a lot of price discovery. It's not a commodity with similarity, you know, between products, but so it's a highly imperfect market, but it is a very free market. You know, when I got thinking about it, we have very little outside influences. I mean, you know, there's a little bit of government program for new, but I mean, almost none for like beginning farmers or something like that, right?
Nothing
there's
significant.
I mean, so, you know, when things do sell, when properties are bought, it is a free market. And some people wanted to dispute that or fuss with that if it's, you know, wealthy out-of-staters or conservation organizations or that kind of stuff. They, you know, but the reality is those are willing buyers, willing sellers. We actually have a very free market in Montana.
Unless you're the CCP.
Called Coulter DeVries.
I don't have any other thought. I don't have any other thoughts around that.
It's kind of a quiet time.
Yeah.
Kind of a quiet time in the market.
I think it's just tough to get anything done because the bid ask spread.
Mm-hmm.
It's too wide. There's no reason for sellers to sober up. They don't have to sell. There's not high debt. There's no liquidity crisis.
Right.
They've been on it for 30 years. They know that. There's no reason to.
Montana land sellers are remarably strong. I mean, they tend to be. I mean, occasionally you see families that are, you know, in trouble or that kind of stuff. But it's pretty rare, actually. I mean, they're usually pretty, we'll wait this sucker out as needed, you know, whatever it takes.
Yeah, and I don't see that changing. I think a lot of these places I'm looking at with these buyers, I'm about 40% off in my CMA from where they're asking, and it's just hard to bridge that gap, and it probably won't get bridged. These deals won't get done.
I got a call the other day about the market, and I was kind of talking about all the, I don't want to say negative factors, but just the things we're talking about, that, you know, inventory is down and volume. I was telling the volume story. Volume's way down and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And he says, oh, great. Does that mean there's deals to be had? I busted out laughing a little bit. Well, it was just interesting because as I rewound what I'd just been saying in any other context, that would be the natural conclusion.
Right.
Like, oh, you know, clearly, you know, in a more normal, more rational, more functioning market, that would be the result.
Yep.
But our market does not play by the same rules.
I've got all these watermelons that are about to go rotten.
Right. Yeah. That's a durable product. I guess that's part of our issue too.
Yep. Well, thanks for coming on.
Yeah. It's been good. Good to be back here.
Thanks for on Montana Land Source.
Yep. Check out mtlandsource.com, live market stats, and every listing on the market, 200 acres and up, is mapped and available on our map app. And
thanks for tuning in to the Ranch Investor Podcast.
Click subscribe on your streaming platform so you know when the latest episode has dropped.